Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
When I saw you and that girl walking down,
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from KCPX Studios in San Luis Obispo. Come along and join us for a fascinating conversation with Gisle Segal, who started a writer's workshop in San Francisco. Hi, Gisle.
Thank you, Tom, for having me. I started a writing organization in San Francisco in 2015 called Right Now SF Bay. And I've offered writing workshops, readings, creative showcases, and anthologies to writers and artists of color and allies. We've published 5 anthologies in the last 7 years, and we do 1 or 2 monthly workshops year-round, and probably about 10 or 12 readings, including some big auditorium events every year.
So here you are in San Luis Obispo, getting ready for an event tomorrow, Sunday, at the Dalladay Adobe. What is that about?
Well, I was down here last year doing some research into my family history, and I met some wonderful local historians who have been really interested in narratives of sort of the hidden histories of Central Coast people of color. Mm-hmm. And coincidentally, it turned out that my grandparents' farm in Shell Beach and also their Japantown properties had also been used in successive layers of history by some of the people that these historians had been studying. I got this idea that I wanted to work on a joint project with these absolutely wonderful folks at the History Center of San Luis Obispo, and then architectural historian James Papp and military historian Eric Brune, and you, of course, with your great knowledge of the area. So we decided to start a series of workshops called Expanding the Historical Narrative, Diversity, Creativity, and Activism. We hope we can get funding for Hidden Histories of the Central Coast.
Oh, cool.
Which would be a larger, more ambitious project. But to kick things off, I didn't know of any writers of color in this area. So I invited down a couple of dear friends and somebody that I've worked with from a distance, but we haven't been able to connect them up until now. So I'm really thrilled to have Sandra Bass and Carla Brundage, who have contributed to several of my anthologies, and Jaime Cortez. So, Sandra, I've known you since 2016, I think. You first came to the workshops in the Fillmore District in San Francisco, and it turns out, I didn't find this out for a long time, she's an associate dean at UC Berkeley, and she's the executive director of the Public Service Center there, and she connects 5,000 students a year with public service opportunities and so forth. She's also an amazing writer. She writes really powerful essays that convey what it's like to be Black in America. Carla Brundage is a poet and a teacher and administrator. She also has a really exciting project called West Africa to West Oakland. That's a poetry exchange between African Americans and African poets. I knew her as a poet, but she wrote for my latest anthology, Uncommon Grounds, and she shared a lot of her origin story, so to speak, and it was fascinating. So I'm hoping that she'll read a little bit from that tomorrow. And then Jaime Cortez we sort of been like ships in the night, you know, been in the same art show maybe, or worked on Rebecca Solnit's San Francisco anthology, but we sort of never really made a personal connection. I was really excited when I heard about his book, Gordo, his wonderful short stories, and they came out last year?
It came out August 2021.
And I kept missing his reading. And I thought, this is a great opportunity to invite him to come down because he has a Central Coast agricultural background. But also, he's a heck of a writer.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. Well, Sandra, tell us a little bit about you and what's closest to your heart.
Thank you so much for hosting us. And I just have to give a special shout out to Shizue. I think the impact of Write San Francisco has been, it's just been extraordinary for people of color who may not have seen themselves as writers. So one of the things I've always appreciated is that Shizue is really looking for the stories that of just ordinary folks and giving them that pathway to getting their voices heard. And so that's really extraordinary. So thank you for that, Shizue. For me, I've always written, but more academically for most of my career. And it was really great to be in a space where I could tap into this other side of my story and my experiences and my family's story. So for this reading we're doing tomorrow, it's kind of interesting. So my family is not from this far down, but my dad grew up in the Salinas Valley, and they came in the 40s. My grandmother was a cook on a what they called then Bracero day labor camp, and they moved around all the way down to Paso Robles with the farm workers. And so I'm going to be reading a little bit of a story about them, as well as my mother's family that settled in Santa Cruz around the same time. And so I really just appreciate, you know, as Sujua was mentioning, there's a rich history here that often is not told. And so I'm excited to have an opportunity to share a little bit about that.
Your process of writing, is some of it therapeutic in kind of a counterpoint to your academic work?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, I think so. Therapeutic, and also, you know, you get to peel back the layers of identity. Because one of the things is you get all these little degrees, you get the letters after your name, that the incentive is to start seeing that as who you are. But that's actually just a credential. And so it's an opportunity to kind of peel that back and really get to the things that are meaningful.
When did you start writing and why?
I've been writing since I was very little.
Like elementary school? Or?
Yeah. I have to tell this story. So I wrote my first book, which is completely plagiarized, when I was five. And I just basically took pieces from other books and I put them together into my book. And I said, well, now it's my book. So I've always known that I wanted to do writing. But you know, it's interesting. I think along the way, and it's one of those things where you can't consciously say it happened at this moment, but you get the message of like, that's not really for you, or this isn't the pathway, or this isn't what you should be spending your time on. And so even though I always knew I wanted to do writing, it kind of got to the wayside unless it was, you know, professional. And so being a part of Shizue's workshop was really an opportunity to go back to that little girl, now no longer plagiarizing, I will share.
So you started publishing?
Yeah. Yeah. I've published, I mean, I did a lot of editing earlier on in my career, which included like articles. And, you know, I guess I'll give it a little shameless plug. I have a blog on the Berkeley website that I update infrequently, but I do like to put things there.
Can you share a story with us?
I can share a little bit of a story that's related to the pandemic that was in one of Shizue's volumes. Very early on in March of 2020, my mother's cousin and her husband died of what then they thought might have been some kind of viral pneumonia. So they actually had COVID before COVID was sort of known. They're one of the first folks in Santa Clara County to die of COVID. And they knew it was something infectious. They didn't know quite what it was. You know, it was this process of like, we could not really say goodbye to them. Actually, one of them survived, the other one did not. But we couldn't say goodbye to her because there was all this concern about, you know, being close to people. And so it got me thinking about this question of, and also there was, you know, they were older, she was 88, and also got me thinking about how we were sort of discounting elderly folks in some spaces. Mm-hmm. And actually people were saying things like, well, you know, just let them go. Yeah. And so I had been thinking about what it meant to be an elder and the importance of elders for a while. And so because of that, I wrote a piece really not only looking at my mentors who had been elders to me, but thinking about how important that role has been in the African-American community, and that without it, we would not have survived, not just physically, but spiritually. Mm-hmm. And so that's how that piece sort of evolved that I published with Shijiwe.
Can you share a story? Tell a tale?
I'll read just a couple of paragraphs.
Okay. And this is an essay?
Yeah, I think sort of a personal essay to some extent. And it's in Essential Truths of Bay Area in Color. And it's called We Will Be Carried Forward Upon the Whispers of Our Elders. And it starts, Dearly Beloved, we have gathered here today to get through this thing called life. That's quoting Prince. One evening in early March, before we were all sent home to shelter, I got a call from my mother. She told me that her cousin and her cousin's husband had been rushed to the hospital. Both were diagnosed with pneumonia. Shortly after entering the hospital, my mother's cousin died. She was 88. Her husband spent weeks linked to life by a ventilator. Tests later revealed that they were both positive for the coronavirus. When my grandmothers died, family members spent hours by their bedsides, soothing them as best we could as they transitioned. Death by an infectious disease, however, is an exceptionally lonely experience. No one was allowed to be close to our kin, to hold her hand, gently knead aching muscles, or express words of love that may have been deeply felt, but perhaps never shared. In her final hours, she did speak to a family member by phone. Her last words, spoken between labored and fragile breaths, were, "Remember me." Traveling upon the misty vapors of our exhalations, this tiny crowned conqueror has wound its way across the globe, devastating families, cities, even countries in its path. Along its journey, it unveiled truths about our current state that are breathtaking in both their beauty and brutality. The sounds of sheltered Italians singing together from their homes in the medieval town of Siena reminded us that our desire to connect transcends our ability to share physical space. And then there were the calls that came from pundits and elected officials to sacrifice our elders on the altars of the American way of life. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick of Texas framed this fatal bargain as such. No one reached out to me as a senior citizen to ask, are you willing to take a chance on your survival in exchange for keeping the America that all Americans love for your children and grandchildren? If that's the exchange, I'm all in. And then it goes on.
Wow. Very cool. So tomorrow you're going to be doing some reading?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to be reading about the story about my family and their experiences here, San Jose, and in Santa Cruz.
Before we move on, back to your life at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's one side of your life.
Yes.
And the other half, how do you deal with that as far as creativity?
Oh, outlet? Gosh. Well, you squeeze it in.
Yeah.
You know, working at Cal is so interesting. I think, it's one of those places where one of my colleagues said one day, I was sort of talking about all the things that happen on campus, and he said to me, you know, Sandra, this is what democracy looks like. And it's absolutely right. I mean, it's just everybody's there, and we're all mixing it up and trying to figure it out. And so it can be a very complicated place, but in some ways it's also a place where I've grown in my insights and empathy.
And one more aside on UC Berkeley, I'm old enough, I remember People's Park and that whole free speech movement, which a lot of people don't understand, mm-hmm. that process that people went through back in the 60s.
So here's what's funny is my center was founded by people who were in the free speech movement and the civil rights movement. So I've been in contact with a lot of those folks, including Mario Savio's widow, who we do work with her. And so I think that piece of Berkeley will always be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one of the things that makes it a unique university in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just thinking, but it's been so much time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mario Savio, I know that name, but I wonder how many younger people do.
Yeah, he has a fascinating life story. So he was a graduate student when they were trying to do some leafletting on Sproul Plaza, which is central on campus, and the administration was trying to shut it down. And so he really became a spokesperson for what became the free speech movement, and this really famous speech where he, you know, was on the steps of Sproul and basically said, you know, we need to be the cog that's not allowing the machine to continue. And that's his most famous thing. But if you actually know his history, he went on to do extraordinary work in all kinds of different human rights movements. And so we now manage the Mario Savio Social Justice Program. We try to speak to that, the fullness of his legacy, because it really is extraordinary.
That's really cool. Is there an anthology?
Yeah, there's actually a book called, I think it's The Orator, his life story. And on the back of it, they have all of his essays and speeches and things like that.
That's really cool. Okay, only because of time, going all day and night. Carla Brundage, little connection with Hawaii, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Mahalo. I've spent a lot of time in Hawaii.
Oh, wonderful, yeah.
Actually, I'll be on Maui in a couple weeks.
Oh, yeah, Maui's beautiful.
Yeah, they're all beautiful. Yeah. So I first went there as a kid and was an assistant to a pharmacology professor at UH when I was 15. It was a very different world back then on Hawaii.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So you grew up in Hawaii?
I did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about Hapa Haole, because as a kid, I always, by default, assumed that was anybody that was part Hawaiian and part from wherever. Could be Asian or Irish or whatever.
Yeah, well, growing up in Hawaii, at the time I grew up, which I was in elementary in like the 70s, that term Hapa Haole did exist, but I don't know that I identified with that term because I'm not Hawaiian, you know, because I'm black.
Right.
But I did at some point claim the word Hapa.
Mm-hmm.
But when I finally came around to claiming it, which was closer to the 2000s, the Hawaiian Renaissance had happened, and there was a lot of like people claiming their voices and their histories. And Hapa now has a different interpretation than it did at the time. And so I don't really claim that term, actually.
Sure.
Yeah.
Understood.
But I have a funny story that there was an anthology that came out, which was supposed to be Hapa Voices. It was edited by Marie Hara. And for some reason, the name of it is slipping my mind right now. And when I first submitted to that anthology, they said that they did not want my voice in there because I wasn't Hapa.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. And then Marie Hara actually advocated for me. So my story is in there, although I don't quite fit that definition.
And what was your story about?
Well, my story was, that's part of the story. My story was, you know, in Hawaii, many people are mixed. And so there was this idea of sort of not really feeling out of sorts at all. But one of the things that was happening, again, things have evolved somewhat. And I think a lot of it is due to the work of a pretty active, tiny black community there. But it would be when I would say the black part. That's when my identity would like somehow explode. Mm-hmm. The emotion would shift, you know? So my story is one of maybe wanting to not be seen, just wanting to be like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And since in Hawaii, a lot of people have an ambiguous identity, I stuck with that until college.
Well, I think that's one of the things I love about Hawaii is that intrinsic multiculturalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a grandson is Chinese, Mexican, and Anglo.
Yes.
And in San Luis Obispo County, definitely a minority. We bring him to Hawaii, and he's like local. You know, it's really cool.
Yeah, it's cool. Definitely, and then there's that other side of it where you kind of don't get to really express your identity if that's something you do want to do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a trade-off.
Interesting.
I would say. Yeah.
Nuances.
Yeah.
So a little bit more about you and tomorrow, what are you going to do?
Well, tomorrow I'm going to be reading a little bit about, Intersecting Circles. The book was called Intersecting Circles, Voices of Hapa Women in Poetry and Prose. That's right. And that word Hapa, That was what got me. But by that time, I was already had lived in the mainland. I had gone to college. I was really big on claiming my identity. So I was very, I felt that rejection. Mm-hmm. Yeah, differently than I would have as a young person.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And where are you now?
I live in Oakland, okay. And I believe I left Hawaii mainly because of that conflict of not being able to feel like I was my full self in Hawaii.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. But not so in Oakland.
In Oakland, I feel more of my full self, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so you're a full-time writer then?
Yeah. I'm a teacher and a writer. I teach high school, and I write and publish a little bit here and there. So, do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so...
Whatever's closest to your heart.
What's closest to my heart? I wanted to start off by saying that also a shout out to Shizue. Writing in Essential Truths as well as Uncommon Ground are my first kind of forays into, not my first, but getting back to prose, kind of thinking about my story and my journey. In Essential Truths, I got to write about my father. And so I've, most of the time, been thinking my whole focus of my life was kind of connecting to that black side of me, which I didn't feel I had been connected to in Hawaii. And then suddenly I was like, well, when my father died also in the early stages of the coronavirus and in the pandemic in a home, I started also thinking about my father a lot. So my father is white, my mother is black, and I've been thinking just a lot about identity. And so Uncommon Ground, the second anthology, I got to talk a little bit about my journey to becoming a writer. And so maybe I'll read a little bit from that. And I just took the literal question that was posed by Shizue, which is, why do you become a writer? So I'll just read a little bit.
Sure, yeah, it'd be great.
Growing up mixed race in Hawaii sounds like a cliche, except for my particular mix. In the Hawaii of the 70s, being part black and part Caucasian was far from the normal melange of exotic combination that are part of the Western psyche found in the remote Pacific. While hapa is a word commonly used in Hawaii for those of mixed heritage, the term has traditionally excluded papolo, black folks. As a child, I was unaware of this and identified as hapa until I learned that being hapa meant Asian and or Hawaiian and white. So my basic tagline became half black and half white. I did not account for any shades or remnants of miscegenation. I did not account for subtleties of ancestry. Most people wanted to know why I was brown and why I was not then of a commonly understood phenotype. My mathematical solution seemed to put all the inquiries at rest. Eventually, I learned there was a term for my specific combination, mulatto, and I embraced it fully. I've been asked why I don't identify as Hawaiian. Simply put, I'm not Hawaiian. Hawaiian people are the descendants of indigenous inhabitants of the Hawaiian Islands who trace their ancestry to Tahiti. My family is from Alabama via slave ship, via West Africa and the Congo, and from upstate New York via Germany and Protestant Reformation comes the family of my father. I also have a number of indigenous ancestors originally from the Powhatan territory, now known as Virginia. Maybe that is why I became a writer. So I feel like I define this whole thing because I feel like that question is always being posed with so many assumptions that I just wanted to explain it very clearly. And so, I just wanted to share that.
Your father, was he first generation to go to Hawaii?
My whole family is first generation to Hawaii.
Okay.
So my parents got married in Boston. It was actually illegal to get married when they got married. And my father got disowned as a result. My grandfather threatened to shoot everyone at the wedding.
Whoa.
So it was a pretty cantankerous thing. Mm-hmm. But the beauty of their story is that my dad went to Wesleyan. And it's kind of funny because it's a very flipped story. My dad is working class. His family was roofers. They were from upstate New York, my white side. And my mom's side is from Tuskegee, Alabama, and they were upper middle class. Everyone was educated, college educated. Everyone had was professors. And so my dad's side of the family, my dad was actually the first in his generation to go to college. And my black mom came from a long line of educated people. My dad at Wesleyan, they were doing those freedom rides. So he went to Alabama for a college exchange and was hosted by two professors from Tuskegee who were are my grandparents. He met my mom, who was home for Thanksgiving, and they fell in love. And then they got married.
And they're still together?
No. Then, because of all the racist things, they had to flee. They moved to Berkeley. And I was born in Berkeley in the summer of love, 1967. And then they stayed there only for 2 years. And I'm going to wrap it up on this. But it is all pretty significant to
what
the story.
What brought them to Hawaii?
My mom's cousin was shot and killed. He was part of SNCC, the SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And he was killed. And my mom and my dad began to have marital problems as a result.
Interesting.
And they thought if they moved to the racial paradise of Hawaii, their marriage could be saved.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually born in Berkeley. And then we moved there when I was about one. My dad got a job. And then they divorced by the time I was three.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. And here you are back in Oakland, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely was like, I have to get back.
Mm-hmm. So you're content and happy being here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look what we have here. Jaime Cortez. I've been reading your book, Gordo, for the last 3 days. A real epiphany for me. You have such a wonderful voice. Such a consummate storyteller that I could hear you tell your stories. I'm really hoping that you will share with us some of your favorite passages from Gordo.
Certainly. I first want to just echo everybody's sentiments and say thank you to Shizue for organizing this and so many other things that you've organized as well. It's a tremendous labor, often goes unacknowledged, and I just want to make sure that we all acknowledge that and just say thank you. So my name is Jaime Cortez, and I am the author of a debut short story collection called Gordo. Gordo is a nickname.
Was that your nickname?
Yes, that was one of 5,000 nicknames I had growing up, because Mexicans will do that. They will layer nickname upon nickname upon nickname. And Gordo was one of them, and it means chubby or fatty.
In your book, you were talking about that. You said that people don't even remember their real name.
Yes, I think that's one of the things that's interesting is sometimes growing up as a kid, when I would learn someone's given name, their real name, after only knowing them for their nickname, I felt like I had uncovered their secret identity. And that comes up in a couple of the stories where like it's almost like this secret of, what's that person's real name? I don't know. Everyone just calls him Fatty. So yeah, and this collection of stories is heavily autobiographical with a bit of fiction in them. And they all take place in the places that I grew up in and in the circumstances that I grew up in. Most of the stories happen on a migrant farm worker camp in San Juan Bautista and in the nearby town of Watsonville, which is where I currently live. I focus on mostly farm worker families and in particular children of farm worker families. I write about that population because I love and care for that population, but I'm also just really kind of struck by the interesting paradox of farm workers in California. Anybody who lives in an agricultural area of California, you will drive past these people doing their labor, and so you see them, and in a sense, they are hyper-visible because their work happens out in the open. And we've all seen it. You've driven past people stooped over picking strawberries, harvesting lettuce, pruning the apple trees during that season when they need to be pruned. All of this labor happens in a very public way. And in a sense, they are, as laborers, hyper-visible, but as human beings, invisible. And that story of what goes into those lives of the people who do this labor that is so critical, yes, to California's economy, but also just the basic feeding of a nation, and indeed the world, because California's agricultural sector is so massive that it actually exports all over the world. I really wanted to get that story of people who are simultaneously hyper-visible and invisibilized. And so that was one of my big motivations for kind of working on these stories.
For me, the most touching were your stories of childhood in the family home. Those just were riveting to me.
Oh, thank you. Yes. And I really focused on these childhood stories, and I tried to kind of hold in balance, yes, the poverty, yes, the violence, yes, the oppression that happens around all of that, the alcohol, the violence, all of that, but to never forget that everyone I grew up with was kind of experiencing that, but in the midst of that, just incredible resilience and resourcefulness and laughter, so much humor, so much laughter. And it was so important for me to hold those things in balance with each other, because I know that my stories are living directly next door to the abject. All that poverty, all that violence, it's abject. And if I didn't have that resilience, and especially if I didn't have the humor, it would just live there. And I don't want to live there, because that's not how I remember people being. I don't remember people being abject. I remember a lot of resilience and so much laughter. And so that was one of the big kind of motivating, animating ideas behind the book.
That's so cool. Can you share, read a little bit?
Sure. I'll just start from the beginning, as they say. The first story in the book is called The Jesus Donut, and I'll just read a couple of pages for you and hope you enjoy it. And this is told in the voice of Gordo, who's me, basically, about maybe 9 years old or so here, and living on a migrant farm worker camp, which, as I remember, I now kind of think of those farm worker camps as being a Mexican village bordered on all sides by California. So that's kind of, when I look back on it now, we were almost not American in some ways. It was such a Mexican place to be. But in any case, this is a brief reading from The Jesus Donut. The Jesus Donut. Soon as the van turns off San Juan Highway onto a dirt road, I could see the cloud of dust chasing it. Don't look like nothing special at first. Just a white van changing into a dusty brown van. When it gets closer, I see it says Flower Child on the side in big curly letters. What does that mean? The van stops close to me and the other kids, and the driver opens the door and steps out. With his pink face, white shirt, white hair, little mustache, he looks like Mr. Kentucky Fried Chicken. My dog, Lobo, doesn't like strangers, and he pulls on his chain, barks at the man. Mr. Kentucky opens up the two back doors of the van. Of course, we're wondering what he's doing. Usually, the jefe, Joe Gyrick, is the only gringo that ever comes to the Gyrick Farms worker camp, so it's not like we see real Americanos here every day. Kentucky looks at us, and he smiles, and he makes a little hook with his finger and calls us with it. I point to myself like I'm saying, "Me? Yes, you, my friend," he says. My cousin Caesar and me put down our sticks and stop our game of changai. My sister Sylvie, our cousins Olga and Tiny, stop playing hopscotch and come over too. The five of us circle around Mr. Kentucky, and he has a big old smile like he's gonna tell us the greatest secret ever. ¿Hablan español?, he asks. I'm surprised to hear him talking Spanish. It's like when I heard a parrot say, "Lucy, I'm home," at my tia's house. We didn't think he could do that. Then Caesar answers, "Yeah, we speak Spanish, English too." Caesar's so brave talking to that big pink white-haired gringo just like that. Maybe when I get to the sixth grade like him, I'll be all brave too. Muy bueno. That is very good, says Mr. Kentucky real slow, like he thought we couldn't understand. Then he turns and opens up the two doors in the back of the van. Inside, it has four big silver metal drawers stacked up. He grabs the handle of the bottom drawer and pulls it open. It opens up. We look. Everyone is surprised. Wow! Holy guacamole! It's so nice. No way, Jose. The whole drawer is full up with donuts. Shiny, perfect donuts all in a row like little soldiers. The smell is really, really nice. We never had no van full of donuts arrive here at the Gyrick Farms worker camp before. Kentucky smiles at us. We smile back at him. He shows us the next drawer. Oh my God, Jesus. It's all chocolate
donuts. Some of them have little rainbow sprinkles, or even better, coconut. This chocolate drawer is so beautiful, nobody says nothing. We stare, it's like a magic show. Kentucky's smiling so hard his eyes get tiny. He opens up the top drawer. 100% cookies. I'm not lying, man, huge cookies. Bigger than your hand. Some oatmeal, some chocolate chip, and some yellow have a nice day smiley face cookies too. It's a miracle. Somebody bought a whole van filled up with donuts to the worker camp here in the middle of the tomato fields in tiny San Juan Bautista. Nobody ever comes to the camp unless they're here to work or visiting the family. Please, can I have one, please, says Tiny. No, stupid, says my sister Sylvie. They're not free. You gotta pay. How much I gotta pay, says Tiny. Not too much, little lady, says the man. They're 12 cents each or 2 for 20 cents. Oh, says Tiny. Nobody says nothing. I feel embarrassed. I don't have no 12 cents or even 1 cent. This nice man drives all the way out to the ranch, shows us the shiny donuts, and nobody has 12 cents to buy one. I think he's embarrassed too. Maybe you can ask your mama, he says. She's working, I say. I point to the tomato fields where my ma and other mothers are working. Mr. Kentucky thinks, and then he says, alrighty, well, maybe next time you can save your pennies and buy a donut, my friend. He closes the cookie drawer, then the beautiful chocolate drawer. Then Olga says, wait, please, can I have 2 donuts, please? Of course you can, little lady, says Kentucky. What kind of donuts do you want? Everyone's staring at Olga, because where'd she get the money? The man gets a pink and white bag and a little piece of paper. Please, I want the chocolate donut with rainbow sprinkles, please, she says. The man gets one, puts it in the bag. Then she points to the tiny glazed donuts on the bottom drawer. He pops one of those in the bag too. 20 cents, he says. Everybody stops breathing. What's she gonna do? She don't got no money. Is she gonna take the bag and run? That would be stupid, because he could chase her in the van. Besides, if she did that, Grandma would hit her so hard she'd see the devil through a hole. I don't know what that means, but Grandma always says that and it sounds pretty serious.
Oh, I love it. Now so I want you to read the rest of it about the whole book. How would somebody find your book? Is it in bookstores?
It is in quite a few bookstores, and if you go to your local indie bookstore, if they don't have it on hand, they can surely order it. It's on Amazon as well and Goodreads. So it's pretty readily available.
So Ask for Gordo?
Yes, Ask for Gordo, and it's also an audiobook. So
by Jaime Cortez.
Yes.
And you did the audio?
Alas, the Penguin did not want me to do the audio. They only want professional voice actors to do that work.
Wow. They missed out on that one.
The guy did a great job. It's not the same as me, but he did a wonderful job.
And was there accent in the reader?
I'm sorry?
Hispanic accent in
the
reader?
Yeah, he had a pretty good grip on it, yeah.
All things considered, you were pleased.
Yeah, you know, I think he did a great job, and I'm always a little bit heartbroken because I would have loved to have read it myself because I experience writing as a very auditory thing. When I write, I'm always speaking it out loud. I need to hear it in my ears to see if it feels true.
Well, and that's the first thing that struck me about your writing is hearing Jaime's voice. It was just resonated through immediately.
Thank you.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, I know what Jaime sounds like when he talks. So tell us about the rest of your life, because you are also an artist, correct?
Visual art is my first love, and probably my greatest love. I just love visual art so much. It makes me the happiest. And I also really enjoy writing, and I remember it was in the third grade that I won my first writing award. The teacher had us all write Easter stories, and we handed them in. The next day we came back, and she had put them all on the wall, and mine had a blue ribbon on it. And I didn't even understand what that meant, like a blue ribbon, and someone explained it to me, and I was like, oh, my God. She likes it. So that was like the proto kind of, that was, I guess, the gateway drug, was getting that one ribbon in third grade. I began editing the school newspaper in middle school and then the school literary journal in high school. So I had this kind of interest in the written word from a pretty early age on.
And back to your art. You do art shows, right?
And then
right?
The art, yeah. I love it. And for a time, it was really my primary pursuit was to try to kind of get traction as a visual artist in the Bay Area. And I got to show in a whole bunch of different venues. And what I kind of realized over time was that I love visual art, but I think writing loves me. And it just seems to be like where my greater strength is. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, visual art is like this beautiful thing that I'm in love with, and writing is this thing that loves me, and I love writing back for it. So that's what I pursue more than anything else these days.
Okay, back to your writing in your book. Mm-hmm. There's a chapter about a hairstylist. Is that autobiographical too?
The hairstylist was based on a person who was kind of legendary in my community in the 70s. So at that time, you know, Watsonville was a smaller community. It was about 15,000 people. And this person, who was in the book, is named Raimundo, was basically the town fruit. Like, he was the identifiably queer person in town.
So he was the same one in the chapter that was harassed by the...
Yes, that's okay. The same kid.
Yeah.
But he's not gordo. Mm-hmm. But it's based on someone who I remember seeing in the 70s. You know, this person, he had hair down to his waist, and he would wear hoop earrings and sometimes a bit of makeup. And I found him, like, riveting and terrifying, because I just felt like, this person is so on the outside of everything. And I found it terrifying to imagine that kind of isolation that could happen from just being so different. And it also was at a point where I was just, you know, knowing that I had these feelings, these attractions, these gay attraction, gay feelings, and I didn't know what that meant yet. And I saw this person, and I thought, oh, does that mean I'm going to become this person who looks so different and who is treated differently, and people will drive past and roll down the windows and say awful things, you know, like that felt really scary to me. But when I look back on it, I just thought, God, the courage of people in those kind of circumstances when they were the only one that was public and they were identifiably so, defiantly so, and lived out the consequences of that. Really kind of remarkable people. And this happened in towns all over the country for such a long time that there would be one person who was just identifiably, visibly, unapologetically queer.
Interesting. We could go on and on. This has been just riveting. Before we go, how to learn more about you, and then we'll go right on around.
Okay, great. Okay. My name is Jaime Cortez. I'm a visual artist and a writer. You can find out more about me at jaimecortez.org, and Jaime is spelled J-A-I-M-E.
I'm Sandra Bass. I'm at UC Berkeley, and the best way to find out about me is to visit our website, which is publicservice@berkeley.edu.
I'm Carla Brundage, and you can find me at carlabrundage.com, that's Carla with a K, or westoaklandtowestafrica.com.
Chizwe, before we go, parting thoughts from you.
I wanted to share something that I just got. I got two emails yesterday. One was from a math teacher saying, I haven't forgotten that you asked for my help in getting your book into Oakland schools. It's a slow-moving process, but I managed to get the attention of someone. And by the way, I'm going to donate $100, and I'm sending you $100 for the books that you sent me.
Very cool.
This is from a conversation a year ago. And then I got another email from a woman who said, hi, I'm a friend and colleague of one of the artists in your book who told me about Uncommon Ground. I was asked to teach an honor seminar at Elmira College in New York with a small group of students, and we read and discussed your section in the book, and a student
Maya Powers was so inspired, she wrote the poem below. And then she wrote like an essay on four of the writers and how each of them had impacted her. But I just want to share my poem that inspired her and her response. Some Girls by Shizue Siegel. What do you mean, go for it? How can you say speak up? Nobody taught me how. Nice girls are agreeable. Nice girls are patient. We don't make mistakes or act without permission. Nobody taught me to love the terrible freedom, the wild solitude. I did everything they told me to. Be patient, they said. Compromise. Cooperate. Wait your turn. Hesitant and yielding, gentle flutter of downcast eyes, inside resentment builds, drop by bitter drop. Inside, the wild bitch screams. So, Maya wrote this poem. One in Five Women by Maya Powers, inspired by Shizue Siegel's Some Girls. What do you mean by, if you didn't say no, you must have wanted it? Why would you say, if you didn't speak up, it didn't happen? How can you think that when nobody taught me about consent? Good girls don't show off, don't wear skirts or flirt. Good girls shouldn't be alone in large crowds or speak too loud. Good girls don't drink, smoke, or vape, or get raped. Nobody taught me how scary it is to simply be a woman in a world where young men's reputations are more important than my body as a safe haven. So that's why I do what I do.
What a home run.
So it's slow moving to get the response. Mm-hmm. I've talked to you before about a lot of times writers of color or people of color, they have other priorities besides writing, like survival, like family. They have pressures about keeping silence for all kinds of reasons. So it's challenging to get real people to share their real stories. But I think it's really, really important work. And I think that it's exciting to think about starting this on the Central Coast and expanding the historical narrative. This writing project that I'm doing with the History Center, I think, is really exciting.
Is this going to be ongoing? There'll be more to come?
Yeah, this is the beginning of a year-long series of monthly virtual workshops. So every month, we'll meet on a weekday evening to be decided for 2 hours. And it'll go on all year, and if we get enough material, we'll publish it for sure online and possibly a print publication as well. So you can find out more about it at my website, which is rightnowsf.com. That's WRITENOWSF, as in San Francisco, .com. My name is Shizue Siegel.
And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Thank you guys so much. What a great day.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Borrachita de tequila llevo siempre la alma mía.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The Foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundationathearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.